centre at 6. An Italian pair who filmed themselves raping a woman in a London nightclub have been jailed for 7.5 years each. One was arrested at Heathrow when he returned to the country for a football match. The husband of a pregnant woman who was murdered with a crossbow says he feels lost as her killer is convicted. Rana Mohammed's ex, Ramanoj Unmathalegadu, was found guilty. A court heard he was obsessed with her. The 35-year-old baby survived. Scotland Yard Detective Sergeant Amjad Sharif says there was an order in place preventing the killer from getting near her East London home.
There was legal mechanisms in place that he clearly chose to ignore, and he took a calculated approach to carrying out the horrible and vengeful act that he did with an extremely lethal weapon.
Another series of organisations has parted company with Prince Andrew over his friendship with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, the English National Ballet and the Tall Ships Trust are among the charities who say the Duke is no longer their patron. Nigel Farage has unveiled the Brexit Party's election policies, but has deliberately avoided calling it a manifesto. Instead, he's described it as his contract with the British people, in which he promised a political revolution. Elsewhere, Lib Dem leader Jo Swinson has been confronted by a student in Glasgow. He's angry her party went back on its word and raised tuition fees when it was in government.
It's just not good enough, Jo. It's just not good enough. I'm a student here in Scotland and luckily I get free education. Look at what the Lib Dems in England, you've betrayed students. I just don't think people will ever forgive you for that.
Two people have died after a tree fell on a car in Gloucestershire. It happened near Winchcombe in the Cotswolds just after 10 o'clock last night. And TSB says it's resolved a glitch that delayed customer payments overnight, resulting in those affected being offered emergency cash. The banks apologised, responding to complaints on social media. That's the latest. I'm Anna Bates.
Only in BCFM.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news will be, he's a little bit late, Labour's Cabinet Member for Housing, Councillor for Central Ward, Paul Smith. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. As you may have noticed, we've been going through the main political parties in the run-up to the general election, starting with Stephen Williams, and none of them are actually candidates in the election. That's because if they were to be, then we might fall foul of election law. We're giving each party a week. This week it's Labour's turn. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, children repatriated from Syria. At the same time, we hear ISIS and see them on video, saying they just walked into Syria from Turkey. Starts to look a little bit like NATO have arranged that, since Turkey's a NATO country. The Turkish intelligence stopped them at the border? No. And on the trail of Martin Bormann again this week, the Holocaust and Bormann. Bormann signing Hitler's decrees, confiscating Nazi goods, acting like a Russian commissar, a bit of a gangster. Talking of gangsters, Benjamin Netanyahu's finally prosecuted. How can he become Israel's prime minister in that situation? Plus the Chagos Islands, Mauritius wants them back. Why? The Britain so reluctant to relinquish these islands? Yeah, maybe something to do with the Diego Garcia US Air Force base and naval base, which is on those islands, eh? Anyway, so to begin with, let's have the that's all that stuff is in the second hour after the US owned Comcast news at 7. So on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 7 Celsius, light rain. This weekend, highs around 10. That's light rain tomorrow, cloudy on Sunday. Next week's high is roughly 11 Celsius, wetter at the beginning of the week, but some sunny showers, sunshine and showers towards the end of the week, windy at times. Next weekend, that's the 30th of November and the 1st of December, again, highs around 11. The same sort of weather pattern, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So we'll be waiting for, apparently he's going to be about 10 minutes before he turns up, Labour's Cabinet Member for Housing, Councillor for Central Ward, Paul Smith. Got lots to ask him about housing, the possibility of a Grenfell happening here in Bristol, as well as the way that the council's dealing with the homeless and people in vehicles, vans, that sort of thing, and those living in the docks on canal boats, that kind of stuff. But anyway, Martin, let's start by looking at the Bristol Arena. It's been a big announcement this week about the arena, some visual plans, etc., being put forward for what's planned up at Filton. Why do we want an arena? Why should we need an arena?
Well, it's been a sort of on the wish list of the great and the good in the city for a very long time.
You mean the
time.
Merchant venturers?
Well, including them, they would certainly be the people.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, we were discussing the merchants the other week, but the great and the good often does mean them. Certainly, I don't think anyone would dispute they're great, but the good is a whole another question around that. But John Savage, who is actually a member of the Labour Party for a long time, quite an active member, is one of the people who's been pushing for this arena for at least the last 15 years, possibly more, maybe 20 years. Mm-hmm. And he's now left the Labour Party, as I understand, because he was not a big fan of Jeremy Corbyn. But anyway, the thing to say there is, of course, he, for anyone that knows about these things, is a former master of the Merchant Venturers. So this is the Merchant Venturers. Does it sit well within the Labour Party?
Well, clearly not. It's like oil and water, really. And the new Labour era brought a lot of people into the party, or there were, and some of them have been there all along, because there's always been tension going back right to the beginning of the founding of the party between a pragmatic right wing who end up doing basically what the Tories would want anyway, and a more idealistic, if you like, left wing that sometimes finds it difficult to communicate its message.
What about the idea of an arena then? Because, I mean, we've had this discussion many times on this programme. Why should the council even get involved? Why would the council want to invest in it when private investors don't? Now, it does look as if this version of the arena happening up at Filton will be a private concern rather than a city council concern.
Well, I mean, back in the day, the idea, you know, Bristol hasn't got, I mean, comparable cities like Cardiff do have an arena when you can put on, you know, political party conferences, for example, and stuff like that. To my mind, you don't necessarily have to copy what other people do. I mean, there's no rule or regulation that says you've got to have an arena if you're a city above a certain size. And Bristol has muddled along without one for quite a long time. So to my mind, it's not necessarily a top priority. But I'm not involved in the decision-making of things like this. It's the sort of thing that's been knocking around for years. Across the political parties, everybody seemed to think it was a good idea for whatever reason. And, of course, the practicalities of it have turned out to be much more complicated than people realise, including things like parking in the centre city centre. And, of course, if we put an arena on the Ring Road, what does that do for, you know, deprived wards in the south of Bristol?
Well,
and the answer is nothing.
One of the main reasons why you might want to position an arena in a specific place is because there's lots of public transport that people can, for example, leave their cars at a remote tram stop or bus stop or railway station and come in by public transport. That would enormously help not only the carbon footprint, but it would also help stop congestion every time there's a concert.
Yeah, but one of the problems with arenas is that you have to have some kind of parking, otherwise people ain't going to come. Yeah, this is one of the problems.
I mean, Temple Mead seems the obvious place to put something like that, but anyway, that's not happening.
Yeah, but the problem is that there's no parking in Temple Mead, which is a basic sort of a question mark against the whole thing of putting the arena down there in the first place.
Well, there could be. I mean, there's an awful lot of land around there, but obviously that land is much more valuable,
well,
not
indeed,
used as
course,
a car car park.
Indeed, exactly. And therefore, the viability of it becomes more and more bizarre, because if you're going to have to use loads and loads of land for car parking, and that's very, very expensive land, I mean, then the whole thing doesn't become viable, does it?
I'm sure this is not, I'm not the first person to say this, but why not? You could have two ticket prices, couldn't you? If you're going to come by public transport, you get a cheap ticket price. If you need a parking space too, you have to pay well over the odds, and then you get your parking space, but, you know, most people are encouraged to come by public transport.
Yeah, but then that presumes the people putting on events there are going to buy into their people paying double, differential ticket prices.
That would be managed by the venue itself.
Well, yes, indeed, but I mean, the whole thing is whether this is a viable venture, full stop, isn't it? So everybody's wanted one in a kind of, wouldn't it be nice to have one sort of way, but whether it's a viable in its previous incarnation or in its new incarnation up at Filton, whether this is really a viable and whether it's helpful to, you know, ordinary people in Bristol are definitely question marks over that.
Well, congratulations to Labour cabinet member and councillor for Central Ward, Paul Smith, who obviously got his jetpack on. And hi, Paul. We're just
Star Trek fan. I just beamed in.
Well done. Okay, so the arena up in Filton, is there going to be Bristol City Council public money going into that, or is it just a private venture?
Is this a question about the general election?
No. Well, it's about the nuts and bolts.
My understanding is that it's completely a private enterprise.
Me too.
Anyway, and not funded
by the
council.
Let's have a listen now, because the Mayor Marvin Rees did a Facebook, I think it's Facebook live chat, a few weeks ago on this very topic. So let's have a listen to hear what he had to say about this whole project.
Let me go through Temple Meads. First of all, let's look at the criteria for that Temple Meads arena. First off, the question is, why is no private sector organisation coming forward to build an arena on Temple Island? There's a simple answer to that. It does not make financial sense. All right? If it made financial sense, they would come together to build it. So if it doesn't make financial sense, is it wise for me to take your money, public money, borrow £160 million that's going to be on your shoulders and the shoulders of your family and your children, and build an arena in the private sector doesn't make financial sense? I don't think that's a good use of public money. Secondly, all the criteria, tax revenues, right? An arena brings us about £400,000 a year in business rates. The mixed-use development brings us nearly £3 million in tax revenues for the city every year. So we'd be sacrificing about £2.5 million a year in tax revenues if we built an arena rather than the mixed-use development. Job creation, the mixed-use development generates three times the number of jobs. Gross value added, the mixed-use development is £900 million over 25 years. The arena is about £380 million. Carbon emissions, the mixed-use development is about a tenth of the carbon emissions of the arena. Size and security. People are saying a 10,000-seater arena is not big enough to be commercially viable. It will not compete. Cardiff are building a 14,000-seater just down the road. Where do we think the world's going to go? Beyonce is not going to play a 10,000-seater, 12,000-capacity arena. And security, as I said, the rail doesn't support it, because if you phone up and say there's a bomb in the arena, what do you close down? You close down the train station too. If you're optimistic and 5,000 people have arrived by train, you've got 5,000 people can't get home. The wrong place. You need about half a mile between your arena and your train station.
It does sound like a bit of a flimsy reason not to put it at the railway station, Paul, that a bomb threat could close the railway station too. I mean, the thing is, a railway station is a great place to have a big venue like that, because a lot of people can come by public transport. Simple as that.
I don't think Marvin was saying in that clip that the reason for not having the arena was because of a bomb threat to Temple Meads. I think he was saying that was one minor issue amongst a whole number of other considerations that he's taken in terms of making the decision.
For you, what's the biggest consideration about where it goes? And do we need it? Maybe we should start by saying, do we need it in the first place?
For me, the consideration always has to be, as somebody representing the centre of Bristol, is how do we ensure that the centre of Bristol doesn't move from where it is at the moment to Cribbs Causeway? And so the sequential test, which is built into the planning system, will do an assessment of whether or not Filton or Cribbs Causeway is a threat to the centre if there's an arena there. On the Temple Island site, the plan is for there to be a conference centre, which in itself will bring a lot of activity into the centre of the city. So I'm waiting to see what the reports say from the consultants on what the impact might be of enhancing Cribbs Causeway against the position of Bristol City Centre.
It just seems the obvious place to put it in the city rather than out right on the fringes somewhere.
That was obviously the view of the council and the mayor himself when it went to full council. And I think somewhere there's a quote from Marvin saying that the best place for an arena is Arena Island, but the best use of Arena Island isn't an arena.
Anyway, we've got a general election coming along. Why should people vote Labour, Paul?
Because Labour is offering the radical change that this country needs, a move back towards government taking responsibility for the economy and the public services of the country, and investment in the areas which has been sadly lacking over the last decade. And really, Labour is the only party that's committed to a huge shift in wealth and resources in favour of ordinary people.
But what about Brexit? We've had enough of all this flim-flamming with Labour. It looks like that's just going to carry on.
Well, let's be really clear. No matter what happens, if Boris Johnson wins and does the so-called Brexit deal by the 30th of January, Brexit will go on for a decade forever, because we will continue to have a relationship with Europe. We'll be continuing to be negotiating and renegotiating our position with Europe. Brexit, whoever gets in, will never end.
But what Brexit is really about is that it's negotiating the terms on which we leave, and that's just carrying on and on under Labour, isn't
it? But we don't leave. We will never leave Europe. We're always here where we are. We will always be trading with the EU.
This is the EU, which is a political organisation. Not just a continent, is it?
Yeah, we will never leave it. It's a fantasy to think just by exiting the democratic institutions of the European Union that somehow we end up leaving it. If we trade with the EU, we will still have to abide by a large number of their rules. We'll just be a disenfranchised member of the EU.
But, I mean, we've been a member of the European Union now since Maastricht, which is, nearly 30 years. Most people think that we don't have any influence. I mean, David Cameron went to try and get his various changes he wanted to stop, or in order to convince people to vote Remain in the referendum, and he failed. I think the last person to actually succeed in getting anything out of the EU was Margaret Thatcher.
Well, the EU is a collective organisation, and therefore the way you get things through it, and I think we've got huge benefits from being within the EU and have huge influence over it, is by being part of that collective. We're going to withdraw from the collective but still be subject to many of its rules. Actually, the best possible deal is to remain within the EU. We may well be leaving in a few months, as I say, the democratic institutions of the EU, but we'll still be in a position where we're dominated by the economic rules of the EU, but also in a position where we're also governed by the economic rules of the US and China. And quite frankly, Britain on its own will find itself in a very difficult position.
The European Commission, how democratic is that?
In what sense?
Actually, well, I mean, you know, it's
the European the commissioners of the EU are nominated from each of the governments within the EU, and all of whom are democratically elected.
So it's democratically elected people then appointing others. But the problem is that
with an oversight from the European Parliament, which we all elect.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Over time, we've seen the powers of the European Parliament increasing as European parliamentarians have said, quite rightly, there's a democratic deficit which we have been elected to fulfil.
Well, they're starting to get a bit shirty, aren't they, with some of the nominees for the new European Commission, because it was supposed to take up its role on the 1st of November, and it's failed to do so because so many of the people, including the chief executive of Atos, the company that was responsible for all of the so-called recommendations that people who had disabled benefits should lose those benefits. He's been nominated by President Macron to be a new EU commissioner, and he's now taking his role. So, I mean, we're talking about a corporate boss now running the whole show. Effectively, these are the people that initiate legislation in the EU, and the new European Commission hasn't been able to start its job because the MEPs have said, well, you're just sending us people that are just no good for this job. And so we may see a new EU Commission starting on 1st of December, but we may not.
So what you've described is democracy in action, that the elected members of the European Union
are creating
a stink about something which they feel is not
but
right.
But let the boss of Atos in. I mean, so do we really want people like that making our laws?
Well, the thing with democracy is when governments are elected, they then put the people that they like into positions, and they may not be the people that we like. And the European Union's no different than that, except it has a jurisdiction over 27 nations.
It's almost like the civil service is in charge of the politicians rather than the other way around. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of this whole, you know, supposed, anyway, democratic deficit in the EU?
Well, as you know, I wrote a book with somebody who became a European Commissioner, Laszlo Andor, as a European Commissioner for Hungary. He was a Commissioner for Jobs and Growth. And he was appointed because he was a very reliable...
So is the boss of Atos a reliable person?
Well, you asked me about me and I'm just responding. He was appointed originally when the socialists were running Hungary, but he carried on his job afterwards when the right wing took over because he was basically competent and they realised that he was well respected. And of course, what actually happens in the European Commission, like lots of other things, like who appoints the people around Trump? Trump appoints them, yeah? And he's elected, even though he got 3 million less votes than the opposition. And that, I'm afraid, is the flawed democracy that we have in the world at the moment. The idea that everything is democratic until the EU came along is ridiculous.
Even in the United States,
it's an oligarchy.
Even in the United States, people do get to elect their president. Nobody has got to actually elect Ursula von der Leyen.
Well, the more extreme Euro federalists say that there should be a direct election for a European president, and if there was a directly elected European president, they could overrule Boris Johnson and say you can't do this, you can't do that, I've got more votes than you.
So why don't they do that?
Because nobody wants that. The Eurosceptic people in Britain do not want a president of the EU telling them what to do.
What about the Remainers?
Well, who are the Remainers?
They're both Remainers.
Well, indeed, but I mean, I'm a Remainer for the reasons that Paul has just outlined. The idea that you can leave and you'll suddenly won't be told what to do by Europe is just not the real world. So it's not for adults,
is it? Don't
you
think there should be a directly elected president of Europe?
I think it's something that should definitely be discussed, and if there was enough Euro-positive sentiment across the continent, then it would be definitely a runner. So you could have a president that could bring in, for example, a massive reflationary programme across Europe. The reason why we can't do reflationary programs in individual countries anymore, in 1981, Mitterrand, who was a socialist packed up by the communists, tried to reflate the French economy, and it didn't work because nobody else played ball. Now, if you're going to reflate the global economy, you've got to have everybody acting together. So you could argue that a democratically elected European government could do that.
Martin,
but we're a long way
Ursula,
from that.
Ursula von der Leyen is not going to be doing that. She's going to be creating something called the European Defence Union, bringing all the European armed forces together. That's what she said she's going to do in the next 4 or 5 years. Anyway, this is we'll try and get through Brexit, shall we?
Yes.
Because we had quite a lot. There was a debate on Tuesday on ITV between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. So let's have a little dip into that now to see what they were saying. And I promise that will be our final. Well, hope I can't promise because then we've got two other people that might discuss Brexit. But let's get it out of the way by having a listen to them and discussing that clip afterwards.
How can this nation trust you to have the personal integrity and individual strength of character to look after our country's interest, rescue us from this mess, and bring us back together?
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much for a very important question. And look, on the issue of trust, I think that trust in politics and in Parliament has been corroded. And that is the most fundamental reason for that is because Parliament asked the people to vote on membership of the EU. And then Parliament has repeatedly refused to honour that promise, to respect the views of the people. And I'm afraid that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are now blocking Brexit. The way I think to, it's absolutely true, the way to restore trust in politics is to get Brexit done and move forward. We have a great deal that enables us to do it. I'm unclear
as to
why it's necessary to spend another year about Brexit, which is, as far as says, is corrosive.
Thank you very much. Time is up, Mr. Corbyn, your first response.
Trust is something that has to be earned. And as a public representative, you have to listen to the people that elected you in the first place. And you have to listen to people all over the country in all walks of life. I spend a great deal of time travelling around the country listening to people, be they chief executives, workers, people sweeping the street, or the homeless. Everybody you meet knows something you don't know. Leadership is about listening to people, trying to put their ideas into practice and finally come to a decision in which you can take a country and our society forward. My style of leadership is actually to listen to people and try and bring consensus together in my own party and obviously within Parliament. Because the issues we face of division in our society do have to be conquered. They're not going to be conquered by diktat, but only by listening and taking us forward that way.
Thank you very much. Farhad.
Yeah. So what would you like to know, Tony?
Well, I'd like to know why, whether you support Mr. Corbyn on what he was just saying. And also, I mean, he's basically flim-flamming. I mean, that's what it seems to me. Why has the Labour Party not got a clear position on Brexit?
So, I've listened to the radio a lot and noticed that if you say you've got a clear position, it means that you haven't. So I won't say that we've got a clear position. Our position is the politicians have completely failed to sort this out. So we need to give a choice back to the people. Well, in fact, because of a lot of the people in the Conservative Party.
The Labour Party,
if all the people in the Conservative Party, including Boris Johnson, had voted for Theresa May's deal, we would have been left in March last year, earlier in the year.
But I mean, the more you leave the less of a soft Brexit there's going to be. Surely, I mean, the best thing to do would be to go for the first May's deal. You should have voted for that and it'll all be over with.
As I said before, it will never be over. It's a fantasy. This is just the beginning of the beginning. It's not the beginning of the end or even the end of the end when we leave those institutions. We've then got the political agreement, which at the moment is supposed to be concluded by the end of December next year. We know from everything else that's happened it won't be. The Labour Party's position is that it's a bit like in a trade union. You know, you have a strike ballot, you go on strike, then you get a deal, then you vote on the deal. So what's being proposed here is that people will have a chance to vote on a deal for leaving the European Union's institutions or remaining in the EU.
But it's not a trade union, is it? I mean, basically, we're talking here about a treaty which really should just be negotiated by the government. The referendum.
Well, we never should have had the first referendum.
Why not? Why don't you like referendums? You afraid of what the people are going to say?
Well, I think very often you get a vote on something, theoretically on one thing, but people are making choices about a whole load of other issues, and it's not straightforward. I'd rather not have had the first referendum. I'd rather not have a second one. But because it's been the politicians have not been able to sort something out, I think, you know, I can see why we have to put it back to the people.
Boris, it seems, has tried to get a deal through Parliament. Labour Party's been blocking him. And actually, the Labour Party was bounced into this general election. Would you admit that?
Yeah, absolutely. But
you didn't want to have
an election. Boris would have had his deal through if his own members had voted for it.
Why does the opposition
not want
an election?
In fact, what he's done is he's kicked out over 20 of his members who didn't vote with him, a large number of whom are now not allowed to stand in the general election as Conservatives. The whole thing has been a nonsense.
Paul, why did the Labour opposition not want a general election?
Well, because for the very reason that we're having this discussion, the general election is being overwhelmed by discussion about Brexit, when in fact a general election is about the way in which the government manages the whole of the public service and the economy. It's not a single issue thing. I would have, if we were going to have a referendum, which I think we may well end up having, that we should have that first and then a general election. I mean, we're putting the cart before the horse.
Martin, what would you make on this Labour position that a lot of people are saying, well, this whole Brexit business is just going to carry on and on and on under Labour?
but it's going to carry on and on and on, as Paul's pointed out anyway. I mean, all that's happened here is a political agreement in which the DUP were thrown under the bus by Boris Johnson. Do you remember they promised the loyalists in Northern Ireland, they gave them £1 billion of our money, even though everybody else was having their schools and hospitals cut, in order to prop them
under a bus. It would be the DUP.
Well, yes, well, I mean, they probably were cruising to be thrown under a bus, weren't they? But the fact is that the only way he's got this political agreement, and it's not a deal, it's just a political agreement with the EU, is by saying that there will be a border in the Irish Sea, which, of course, is music to the ears of Sinn Féin and horror to the loyalists. And, of course, that's when the whole thing started to come off the wagon, because the whole Tory majority depended upon the DUP. And, of course, at that point, and when, of course, what may happen if Johnson wins a majority, even if he hasn't got a majority in the country, because, of course, the first-past-the-post system in our country can have that result, is that he will then tear up the deal he's done with the EU and try and go for a no-deal Brexit, which is why we've been opposing that all along, because we don't want a no-deal Brexit. I can live with a Norwegian-style love.
Paul, can you tell us when we will leave the EU and if we
never
will leave the EU?
We will never leave the EU. That's what I've said, and I've said it all along. We are tied in economically so strongly to the EU that we will always be dependent upon it, and we will always have to abide by its rules.
Even if Boris wins?
Even if Nigel Farage became the Prime Minister of the country and we had 600 Brexit Party MPs, which I know is impossible at the moment, we would not leave the EU.
Interesting. Well, what about Jeremy Corbyn? Are you a supporter of him?
I'm a supporter of Labour's policies, and Jeremy's our leader, so I support him as our leader.
Would you support anybody as leader of the Labour Party? If whoever was leader?
Well, it depends. of course not whoever was the leader, but I'm very supportive of the political position.
There is a problem.
I'm one of those that has always taken the view, and it's certainly a view of the man who used to be MP for where we're sat now, that politics should be about policies, not personalities. It's not soap opera.
I know, it'd be nice if it was, but often people do vote on personalities rather than policies, because they can't be bothered to go through all the manifestos. Boris Johnson is polling around about 41% and Corbyn around 22%. So
28.
Well, this is a YouGov poll today. Mm. Okay, so I mean, obviously the polls. Each party always quotes the polls it wants to, but I'm just quoting the latest on Britain.
I think we find there's also been a piece of research that says that no political leader in this country has ever been as vilified by the media as Jeremy Corbyn has been. And so the fact that he's polling as high as he is remarkable, given the way that he's been treated by a lot of the mainstream media.
Can he climb back? Or do you think the personality actually matters? Do you think people do vote on personalities, like I said?
Some people do. I knocked on doors when people would say, I'm not voting for that Neil Kinnock. I'm going to vote for that Margaret Thatcher. So there are some people who treat it as if it's like a presidential election. But I'm not a member of the Jeremy Corbyn party or the John McDonnell party. I was never a member of the Tony Blair party. I'm a member of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party is a democratic socialist party, which has got particular principles, which are the ones that I support. It's not about who is the particular leader at a particular time.
Does it not make a difference between someone like Ed Miliband? Why do they bother even changing leaders then?
Well, Ed Miliband resigned, so you have to elect a new one.
Because he lost in the 2010 election. Anyway, let's have another listen to the debate between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson on ITV from Tuesday. But this time, nothing to do with Brexit. This is all about foreign policy.
This is a question from Tony from Bristol. Which current foreign leader do you most admire, Mr. Johnson?
Which current foreign leader? Well, it's a very good question. I think I would like the EU27, all of them, because they did me a fantastic deal, which enables us to come out of the EU. And I have yet to hear, and I'm going to ask him again. I've yet to hear what the leader of the opposition would do with his deal and whether he campaigned to leave or remain. I feel obliged to ask this question.
Mr. Johnson, Mr. Corbyn.
I think the person I admire most in the world at the present time is the General Secretary of the United Nations, Guterres, trying to bring the world together.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Well, I don't know what to say about that. So, I mean, foreign affairs is what we discuss on this show in the second hour in great detail. So that was a pretty shallow response by both of them.
I thought it was a very poor performance by ITV, actually, because foreign affairs is quite an important thing that we want to know a little bit about from our leaders, surely, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Britain is an island, but it also has a place in the world, and therefore is very important. And I was a big supporter of Robin Cook's idea of an ethical foreign policy, which wasn't about individuals. It was about, you know, what were organisations doing.
And but the trade unions wouldn't like that, would they? They'd see arms workers laid off all across the country. If we're not allowed to sell arms to Saudi Arabia...
Well, we do need to look at how we transform our economy so that it's not dependent on arms. There's lots of fantastic skills in things like the aero industry and the arms industry. But what we've got, we're not at war with anybody. What we've got is a climate crisis, and we need those technological expertise to be transferred to looking at how we can deal with the climate crisis.
Well, it'd be nice to think we weren't at war with anybody, but we've certainly got a lot of British forces personnel over in Saudi Arabia helping them to fight Yemen. So there are these conflicts going on. We've also got British troops over in Afghanistan still. There's all sorts of places where the British troops are around the world. So we're fighting this kind of nefarious war on terror. What do you make of that?
Well, I, you know, whether it's the war on drugs or the war on terror or the war on anything else, I think it's, you know, bad use of language, really. I don't, when people talk about the war on something, I do cringe a little bit, because I'm not sure that it's actually very meaningful. It's just sort of macho posturing.
It's a bit of an endless war, Martin, isn't it? It's the sort of thing George Orwell talked about, you know, the war on terror. We're just going on and on and on with this. And I was just very disappointed that ITV didn't really do anything much about anything in the rest of the world. This general election will affect the rest of the world and will affect our foreign policy.
Yeah, well, the main foreign policy issue is the B issue we were discussing earlier, the Brexit issue, and of course that's what the dumbing down process leads to. We have actually been to war. I mean, loads of these Tories who were going on about sovereignty and all the rest of it, and how crummy Jeremy Corbyn is, they all voted to go to war in Iraq, as many people on the right wing of the Labour Party did, and of course we're still living with the consequences of that. Millions dead. Refugees pouring around the world looking for somewhere to hide, you know, potential for a real blow up between Syria and its neighbours Israel and so on, and this was what we should be talking about, but instead we're looking at gazing at our navels and talking about the EU.
You are. We've finished actually on that one, but anyway, going back to the ITV debate, how well or badly do you think Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn? This is another YouGov poll. Actually, Corbyn did extremely well. He got 67% saying he did well, and only 59% saying Boris Johnson did well, Paul.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, Boris was in his sort of bullying best, speaking over the moderator, taking time, rather than addressing issues, trying just to insult Jeremy Corbyn, whereas I thought Jeremy was very respectful and calm and measured, and when he was asked for short answers, he gave short answers.
He seemed to be able to think on his feet a bit better than Boris. Boris seemed to have been sort of almost groomed so that he was going to, you know, obviously talk about Brexit almost every opportunity.
Well, Boris has got one answer to every problem this country has got, which is get Brexit done.
Boris did okay. The other part of that poll is who did badly and who did well. So Boris Johnson, people 41% people think Boris did badly, and 32% thought Jeremy did badly. So Jeremy's won quite well. He's 10% higher as a bad person on that debate, according to YouGov, Marty. So I mean, it's actually probably quite positive Jeremy Corbyn to be taking. The main thing here, just a second, is that Boris doesn't have to do these debates. He's chosen to do it, and actually...
Well, he's not doing the one on Sunday on Channel 4.
Why not?
I don't know, but he's pulled out of it. He's obviously been told.
He's been looking at the figures you've seen there.
He didn't do very well in the first one, and he's the one with a lot to lose. He's got a very, despite, you know, him being a complete serial liar, he's got a fantastic rating compared to Jeremy, and he knows that every time people are exposed to the both of them together, he comes off worse.
Interesting. So, Martin, what do you make of the whole... why has Boris been doing these debates? He doesn't seem to have been doing very well, and maybe potentially can't think on his feet as Jeremy.
Yeah, but you've got to imagine what he's trying to do is rally his own Leave base. And, of course, he wants it to be seen as a contest between him and Jeremy Corbyn. And, of course, in posh parts of the country, Jeremy Corbyn is worse than Satan. So if that's well, that was the calculation. But, of course, in other parts of the country, Jeremy Corbyn is regarded as, you know, as it says, JC, yeah, with the beard and everything. So he's not Satan to those people.
OK, well, also, another few things to do with the YouGov poll to do with that. That debate on Tuesday, how many think that each of the leaders is in touch with ordinary people? Johnson gets 25%, Corbyn gets 59%, nearly 60%. So obviously he's connecting somehow, Paul.
Absolutely, and you know, I think that is a reflection of reality. You only have to see the way, for instance, in which you know, we had the issue around Grenfell, when the difference between Jeremy and Theresa May in terms of relating to the victims of that outrageous tragedy. We almost saw that repeated in the floods in the north of England with Boris, who did some weird dance with a mop in a shop doorway at the beginning, and then was very late going in to visit local people, most of whom told him to bugger off. He was 4 days late.
Okay, so let's move on. And Bolton Fire. Government is downplaying risks of HPL cladding, say critics. Pleas to remove flammable cladding were apparently being dismissed as recently as a fortnight ago. This is last weekend, Paul, up in Bolton. Another building, cladding catches fire. I'm sure you've seen the pictures.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all dripping down the side of the building in flames. Mm. So people out there living in buildings in this city with cladding, both private and council, which you obviously are responsible for, will be concerned that that couldn't happen here, could it or couldn't it? Can we have an absolute guarantee here?
Well, in terms of the council cladding, we've tested it. It's been tested in real circumstances. There's been fires in council buildings. The cladding in none of those fires has caught a light, and fires have been contained within the flats. We've done an ultrasound test of all of the cladding, and where we've seen that there's any issues, we've dealt with them very quickly. In the private sector, obviously, there's a bigger problem. We know that there are still buildings with ACM cladding in Bristol, and
is this the Grenfell stuff?
Yeah, absolutely, and that is due to be stripped off and replaced.
What if there's a fire in between times?
Well, at the moment, those buildings have got 24-hour fire marshals in them.
What about council? Can you absolutely guarantee that nothing like that Grenfell could happen or Bolton could happen?
Absolutely. I mean, we've gone round with the fire service. We've checked. I mean, we check all of our tower blocks every year with the fire service anyway. We went round again after Grenfell. As I say, we've been checking for things like fire breaks, because one of the issues at Grenfell was the lack of fire breaks. We've been checking our compartmentalisation. That was something else that had been disrupted at Grenfell in the blocks. We've got we've also been checking our fire doors. So we're very confident that when there are fires, and there are fires regularly within flats, just by the nature of any building, you know, there's a danger of fire, particularly from a kitchen, that they will be contained and people will be dealt with. We've also, in some instances recently, evacuated buildings or parts of buildings. We haven't radically insisted on stay put, but what we do is we take a measured approach with the fire, or the fire service take a measured approach to decide whether to get people to leave or not. Because we had an example recently where people left Carolina House in Dove Street. Nobody was injured, the fire didn't spread, we've been able to contain them all.
Martin, what do you make of the policy on this? Because I think there's quite a lot of people out there thinking, well, actually, politicians, governments don't really care. There's still cladding on these buildings. And even though we get guarantees from people like Paul here, people are still worried. They're nervous. They don't actually trust politicians to sort this out.
Well, it was Fielding Mellon in Kensington who decided to put...
Yeah, the deputy leader of
Kensington
and Chelsea...
Decided to put this particular cladding up.
The deputy leader of Kensington and Chelsea Council, Rock Fielding Mellon, whose family estate is up at Cheltenham, just outside Cheltenham, that did that. Yeah,
yeah. Well, and of course, and what I think is particularly disgusting about it is they decided to A, it was cheaper to have this particular kind of cladding, and B, they wanted to put cladding on the building because it was a 70s style old Labour, if you like, council block, and it stuck out like a sore thumb in posh Kensington. So they put the part of putting the cladding was simply for cosmetic purposes, to keep the house prices of people who lived in the nearby streets, because they didn't want to look out on a horrible council block in the middle of their manor.
Of course, in 2014, a government housing minister blocked approaches from an all-party group to actually review flammable cladding.
Who was that?
That housing minister happened to be Stephen Williams, who was then the MP for Bristol West.
Yes, and I have to hold my hands up here because Stephen was in here a few weeks ago. We were discussing Grenfell, and when I got back home, I picked up my phone and various listeners had been texting and saying, well, why didn't you pull him up on this? So what did Williams do at that point, or not do?
Well, what he said, that there was an all-party group that said that they wanted to look at the regulations relating to cladding on the outside of high-rise buildings because they were concerned about the safety. And Stephen Williams wrote back and said, sorry, I don't want to disrupt the work of the department by looking into this.
Well, that's an appalling thing to say, Stephen. I'd love to have put that to him, and I certainly will next time he's back in, Paul. But anyway, now, what's the big story of the week? The big story, Prince Andrew, of course. Now, let's have a listen to Prince Andrew speaking. Actually, no, let's start off with Virginia Roberts speaking to the ABC documentary, which hasn't been shown on the UK. I thoroughly recommend it. It really does go into detail about Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and other people involved in this child sex trafficking ring, which appears to have been helped by intelligence service of one sort or another, due to the vast amounts of money, unlimited amounts of money, apparently, Epstein seemed to have access to. So let's have a listen to the ABC 60 Minutes, a clip from that, chatting to Victoria Roberts, Virginia Roberts.
I was trafficked to other billionaires. I was trafficked to politicians, professors, even royalty. It was the elite of the world. It was the people who run the world. It was the most powerful people in the world.
Why do you think Epstein did that to you?
He used me as a form of blackmail. So, you know, these people would owe him favors. So he wanted to always have something on someone just in case he needed it.
Virginia has named the men she was trafficked to in documents lodged with the courts. The name that has caused the greatest splash is Prince Andrew. The pair captured in this now infamous photograph taken in 2001.
So as you know, Prince Andrew denies the allegations against him, and he says that this photo is a fake, that he was never there, and that he's not his arm. And they're not his fingers.
Those are his fingers. That is Andrew. This photo has been verified as an original, and it's been since given to the FBI, and they've never contested that it's a fake. And I know it's real. And he needs to stop with all of these lame excuses. We're sick of hearing it. This is a real photo.
And that was the first time you met him?
And that's the very first time I met him. And that's right before I was abused by him.
Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell took the 17-year-old Virginia to London to party with Prince Andrew.
Then we went to Club Tramp and he danced with me and he sweats a lot and he smells funny. And then we get in the car and Ghislaine tells me in the car that I have to do what I do for Jeffrey for Prince Andrew. And that's when I learned what was going to happen.
How many times were you trafficked to him?
3 times.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there's a lot more to this story than the embarrassment of Prince Andrew. He's been caught up in this, and that's what people have picked up on, because people like all the salacious detail, don't they? But Epstein clearly is a blackmailer. The question is, was he working alone or was he working for an intelligence service or intelligence services? I mean, and I think a lot of this VIP pedophilia, including the stuff with Jimmy Savile and the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, which people, regular listeners to this show, will know about, intelligence services use paedophilia as a means of blackmail, and that's why all these wealthy, powerful people end up sleeping with underage boys and girls.
Interesting, isn't it, that it's Prince Andrew that is the person talked about and mentioned. She's saying there, in fact, she's submitted apparently to many to court papers, many, many names of top politicians all around the world, including, as she said, their professors, etc.
Yeah. And that, obviously, what people are picking up on is the royal connection, isn't this shocking coup, you know, all the usual, as I say, salaciousness. But in actual fact, the real scandal is that there's it's probably Mossad and the CIA are using these girls and boys in other circumstances. In Kinkora, it was all boys. MI5 were using Kinkora to try and blackmail loyalist paramilitary leaders, because they, once they've been, you know, they used to photograph them having sex with underage boys. That's all well known in Northern Ireland.
Okay, so before we hear from Paul Smith, let's have a listen to this week's BBC interview with Andrew replying to those sorts of allegations.
To sweat. And it's only because I have done a number of things in the recent past that I'm starting to be able to do that again. So I'm afraid to say that there's a medical condition that says that I didn't do it, so therefore...
Is it possible that you met Virginia Roberts, dined with her, danced with her in Tramp, had sex with her on another date?
No.
Do you remember meeting her at all?
No.
Do you know you didn't meet her, or do you just not remember meeting her?
No, I have. I don't know if I've met her, but no, I have no recollection of meeting her.
Because she was very specific. She described the dance that you had together in Tramp. She described meeting you. She was a 17-year-old girl meeting a senior member of the royal family.
Never happened.
She provided a photo of the two of you together.
Yes.
Your arm was around her waist.
Yes.
You've seen the photo.
I've seen the photograph.
How do you explain that?
I can't. Because I don't, I have no, I, again, I have absolutely no memory of that photograph ever being taken.
Do you recognise yourself in the photo?
Yeah, it's pretty difficult not to recognise yourself.
Your friend suggested that the photo is fake.
I think it's, from the investigations that we've done, you can't prove whether or not that photograph is faked or not, because it is a photograph of a photograph of a photograph.
Prince Andrew speaking to Emily Maitlis on BBC Newsnight last weekend. Paul, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's a classic example of how powerful men take advantage of vulnerable young women and children, and it's obviously completely despicable. And Prince Andrew should be over to the States giving evidence to the people acting on behalf of the victims to give them whatever he knows. Obviously, he's got a very patchy memory. He remembers some things incredibly well and other things he has no memory of whatsoever, but he should be going over there. He should be making available information to the people acting for the victims, and he should also be making himself available to the legal process in the States, as anybody should. I mean, we've got a case starting in Scotland now with Alex Salmond. We don't obviously, we're at the beginning, we don't know what that will find, but, you know, there is a problem with men with power feeling that gives them the right to do all sorts of things.
Ultimately, though, Martin, there's all sorts of interesting aspects to this. I mean, Andrew's visit to Epstein after he'd been convicted and done time does almost look to me as if Andrew's going over to say to him, well, okay, have you got any evidence on me? And he actually goes out, doesn't he, for a walk in Central Park with Epstein, which looks to me as if he doesn't want to be inside a house where he might be under surveillance. He's going to have a confidential chat with him about what evidence have you got on me. Now, we know that his New York mansion was absolutely cameraed up all over the place, and yet in one of those interviews, Prince Andrew, the Prince Andrew interview, he says, I never saw Epstein with a camera.
Well, of course, if you... this microphone's been, of course, if you're going to blackmail people, you don't get the cameras out. You build it into the mansion. And my best guess, and it's only a copper's hunch here, is that Epstein was working with Mossad and the CIA, or the CIA branch of Mossad. And they're using this as basically blackmail. And they get everybody in there. you know, she listed all these, you know, politicians, senior people in public life, and get them dirtied up, as the mafia say. And that's how the real world works, folks. You think you live in a democracy, but that's not how it works. And this is, you know, we've just pulled back the curtain here to see a tiny bit of what really goes on behind the scenes. Intelligence services in the Western world and elsewhere are far more powerful than people realise.
Now, this does remind me a little bit of the MP's expenses scandal, because, of course, there were certain people who were listed in there that never, ever got, for example, Tony Blair's expenses were never made public.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it was all, as at the time, if you remember, Tony, we were investigating this from our own angle, and it was definitely not a leak. Somebody had broken into the House of Commons office and stole the hard drive, if you remember, which had all the MP's expenses on it. And he was an I've forgotten his name now, but he was an ex-SAS guy. And he got in there and broke it. And he went round touting this to the various, media people. And it was the Telegraph that took the stuff. But what they did is he then had people going out. And Cameron went out to Sark. If you remember, we went to Sark to look into this. Cameron flew out there. And they said, we've got all this dirt on all these people. And Cameron used it to get rid of people he didn't want inside the Conservative Party. But people who played ball were protected. And, of course, Tony Blair's expenses were in there. Okay. But we never heard anything about
it. Question here is, why might someone be trying to spin Andrew out of public life? Because, I mean, obviously the Queen is getting very old. At some point, there's going to be a battle over the there may well be a battle over the succession as to whether Charles takes over or William. And it means now that I suppose in the old days it was they'd throw you off the top of the castle wall or drown you in the moat. Nowadays it's a character assassination pool. Would you say it's that actually Andrew may be a victim here of a sting operation?
I don't think Andrew's was particularly in line for anything. I mean, I just think
he has a powerful voice. He's the second son of the Queen, doesn't he?
I think, yeah, but he's never going to be king, is he? I mean, he keeps slipping down the list. So I don't think it's about anything within the royal family. Whether there are other shenanigans, I mean, he's not really a very important figure, and without this we probably all would have forgotten he even existed.
Well, one of the things that surprises me is that if he's going to be pilloried and hung out to dry, it really should be over his aiding arms sales to Saudi Arabia and that sort of thing, rather than having sex with the 17-year-old.
Well, that's true. He's certainly been out there selling British arms. That's his job insofar as it's called one. He used to hang around in Central Asia selling arms because, of course, he was in the army and all the rest of it. But I think the real thing about this is, Tony, there are much more important people who are entrapped in by Epstein, senior politicians who are still in office. And of course, if we all go on about Andrew, we're not talking about the rest of it. It's a way of dumbing it down so it's just about his salacious behaviour rather than the fact that Epstein was probably an intelligence agent and possibly not even possibly murdered or possibly still alive somewhere. Right.
Did you see his body?
But the guys that were supposed to be guarding him are now being charged because they were supposedly asleep when he committed suicide.
Anyway, finally, Paul, Labour Party has had its manifesto this week. Would you like to just pick out a couple of things?
Well, as you would expect, I would highlight the housing policy to massively ramp up the delivery of council housing and social housing within the country, and a huge investment in that, and an investment that produces a return. Investment in public housing, it always eventually brings back more money than you've invested in it. So I'm very pleased about that. Things like bringing services like water, for instance, back into the public sector, I think is really important.
I wonder what Bristol Water will have to say about that.
Well, I'm not sure that Bristol Water has ever been in public hands, has it? I think Wessex Water has been.
They managed to dodge it last time, didn't they, after the war.
But, you know, moving away from this sort of Chilean style privatisation of everything, I think is absolutely important to reverse that and to start investing in public services and championing public services.
Thanks very much. That was Paul Smith. He's the Bristol City Council's Cabinet Member for Housing and Labour Party's Councillor for Central Ward. And that ends our look from the Labour point of view for the general election. We'll be back after the news to spread our wings around the world.
From the Sky News Centre.